Good afternoon. I'm David Chappell. Welcome to this session on NoSQL on Azure. This is my third session here at TechEdEurope. It's my last one. And it is the most technical of the talks I am doing. None of my talks are very technical. I'm not a very technical guy. But it's the most technical. And so in honor of that, I'm going to remove my jacket just to try to appear more, you know, more technical. How's that? I live for big pictures. I love big pictures. If I had a store, it'd be called Big Pictures R Us. I love giving big descriptions of things, and that's what this talk is about. It's this big picture view of NoSQL, or more correctly, of non-relational technologies on Azure, all right? So the main idea is this. The main idea is that NoSQL technologies are absolutely a fundamental part of Azure today. You might not know, they might not believe that, but it is true. And when we're done here, I hope you all believe that. So, some comments about data today. Data is as critical as it ever was. The people who pay us, the guys we work for, I would argue care fundamentally about data. I have done, for example, roughly 100,000 talks on public cloud computing in the last 6 years. In every talk, every time, people raise their hands and they say, David, what about security? What about trust? And they're always talking about their code? No, their data. Their data. Data is so fundamental. Maybe you remember this. Our field, which is now called information technology, that sounds very cool, right? Our field was called data processing for the first few decades. I wish it was called that still today, because it focuses on what we really ought to care about, which is the data. And of course, we have more and more data all the time. Storage costs get lower and lower. The things that create data get more and more capacious, get bigger and bigger. So we have web scale apps. We have this whole IoT thing happening. We have more and more data all the time. And finally, new data technologies abound. The NoSQL world, the rise of big data analytics, the rise of search, which you might not have thought of in this context. When I'm done today, you will, I promise you, right? I would argue that this is not the post-SQL era, but it is the SQL plus era. There are zealots. There are NoSQL zealots who will tell you that the age of the relational database is over, that going forward, NoSQL owns the future. Those people are nuts, right? They're just wrong. The truth is that it is absolutely the SQL plus era. But relational stuff will matter for a long time to come. Let me tell you a story. My first book, I wrote in 1989, a long time ago. I got a royalty check for that book about 6 months ago. One is due when I get home this week. The book is a second edition that changed almost nothing, right? What possible technology could be in a book that is still being used, almost unchanged, 25 years after it was written? The answer is SQL. The book's one of the first intros to SQL on the market. That book was used on a syllabus at MIT last semester. 25 years old, still the same. That is how constant SQL has been. It's not going away. It's not going away. But it is absolutely being augmented by this whole range of SQL plus technologies that are our topic this afternoon. This is totally irrelevant, but listen to my story, will you? When I wrote this book in 89, it was the dawn of desktop publishing, the beginning of the time when you could have a laser printer, do your own book layout, you know? And I was so excited about that. I convinced the publisher, Wiley, that I should do book design, choose the fonts, all the layout, give them camera-ready copy, and they said, yeah, sure, Dave, whatever. And I did this. By the end of the process, I was more excited about the book design than the book content. It was really fun. Not long after it was published, maybe 6 months or a year, somebody from Wiley came to me and they said, David, you know, we're using your book as an example of book design for new book designers. And I thought, oh, that's so cool. I'm so happy that. And then they finished their sentence. They said, David, it's an example we use to show them how not to do book design. Knowing how to do them, having the tools, having the talent are different things, right? For my future books, I had the publisher design all the time. But I still like my first book's design. I don't know. They didn't like it. All right. What else is happening? The rise of NoSQL is big, so we're seeing more and more use of more and more diverse types of data as the world transitions from the SQL era to the SQL Plus era. We're also seeing the world moving from on-premises to cloud. And so the trend is totally toward the upper right-hand corner of this graph. That's where we are this afternoon. I'm talking about the upper right-hand corner of the graph, the intersection of the SQL Plus world and the cloud. Diverse data on Azure. So let's start by talking about NoSQL services on Azure. I already confessed to you that I love big pictures. The truth is, I cannot think about details without some kind of frame to put them in. And here's the frame that I find personally useful to think about SQL and NoSQL technologies on Azure. It's common today to categorize data in two big buckets. There's operational data, the stuff you read and write, the thing that records your transactions and your customer purchases and your changes to employee databases and whatever, operational data. Then there's analytical data, the read-only stuff that you do BI on. This is the whole world of data warehouses and so on. Right, two big categories, read-write operational, typically read-only analytical. The rows in my diagram here are, unsurprisingly, SQL technologies, relational, and NoSQL technologies. These four quadrants give us a way to categorize the NoSQL and the SQL technologies on Azure today. So in the lower left, you've got relational databases, operational data in the relational world. We know that space. On Azure, there's SQL database. Oh, you're wondering, why all the colors? The colors actually have some meaning. The stuff you see in yellow is a managed service provided by Azure. What that means is you can use this by just talking to an interface, whether it's a UI or a RESTful interface, some kind of call you make. You can just say, I want a database, you can get it. You need not install software, manage a server. They're managed services. The things in yellow are managed services provided by Azure. The things in red are software you can install and run if you choose to in Azure's IaaS virtual machines. So you can, of course, install SQL Server or Oracle or MySQL or whatever you like as your relational database system in an Azure IaaS VM. Okay? For the next piece, analytical data that's relational, there's no service right now, but you can do relational analytics by running SQL Server, Oracle, whatever, in an Azure IaaS VM. Our focus this afternoon, though, is the top row. In the top row, there are a bunch of things. Document stores, one of the big categories of NoSQL. There's DocumentDB, a managed service in Azure. I'm also free to run Mongo or other document databases in IaaS VMs. If you're saying, what's a document database, I will tell you. Okay, the assumption is not that you know that, but I'm doing the categories first. Okay, we'll describe those things in a few minutes. I can have a key value store. Azure provides tables as a managed service. Again, what I mean by that is something I can use without installing and managing my own servers. It's just there. It's just there. You can do other things as well. I can install React or other choices. For column family stores, Azure provides HBase as a service, more or less. You can also install things like Cassandra and so on if you wish to. And finally, the upper right-hand corner, analytical data. That space of non-relational analytical data essentially has only one technology. One thing has won in that space. That one thing is Hadoop. And so you can run Hadoop clusters if you want in virtual machines. You can also use HD Insight, which is the managed service. All right? So this summarizes what we're going to talk about. I am going to focus entirely on the things in yellow. SQL database, quickly, the three up there, and HD Insight. Okay? So with that as our frame, let's start. I want to begin with a very quick look at SQL database, primarily because we're comparing the NoSQL world against the SQL world generally. So to get us all on the same page, I want to do a very quick look at SQL. This was called SQL Azure for several years. It actually had two different names before that. It's changed names. This is the fourth name, I believe, the technology. But anyway, SQL database it's called right now. The idea is obvious to most of you. You've got tables, tables have columns, columns have names and types. So for example, suppose I'm building an app on Azure that's using SQL Database and wants to store information about the users of the app. Maybe it's an app, maybe it's a game. I've got an ID column, the integer. I've got the user's name, their country, their age, the date of last use. Those are all types supported by SQL. And you're saying to yourself, why is he doing a little SQL tutorial here? It's because I'm going to compare this data structure in later NoSQL environments. So take a look at that for a second. There are rows, of course, records. There are IDs. There's data. Fine. There's a primary key. Applications issue a SQL query and get back rows and columns, a relation. The basics of relational systems. In SQL Database, you don't have to worry about managing the actual database software. It does that for you. Okay? Brief digression. In the world of databases, there is this idea called sharding. And here's the idea. Conventionally, in relational databases, you ran the database on one machine, just one machine. You'd have data about Adam and Cynthia and Bill and everybody on that one machine. If you wanted to scale, what did you do? You bought a bigger machine. Classically, relational databases scaled by getting bigger and bigger machines, commonly called scale up. Well, it is also possible with database systems to scale out, to spread data across different machines. Today, that's commonly called sharding. And the notion is that you break your database into some number of shards, commonly arranged with some common characteristic. Here, for example, all the A's are in shard 1, the B's are in shard 2, and so on. Great. I can scale by sharding across many machines. It helps with scale, but there are some limitations. In particular, atomic transactions, which we care a lot about in many cases, ACID transactions, typically don't work across shards. Now, they could. We can do two-phase commit. We know we have the technology, but it's too slow. And so folks don't commonly do transactions across shard boundaries, as you're going to see here. Now, historically, relational systems have not done sharding. And in fact, SQL Database did not do sharding seriously until just a couple of weeks ago when they announced the preview of SQL Database Elastic Scale, which is a client library and some more to support sharding in SQL Database. So that's interesting. We're starting to do sharding in relational systems. You're going to see sharding is fundamental to NoSQL systems. I'm going to build this table throughout my talk. And since we're comparing against relational, we'll start with SQL. It's a relational database, great. The core abstractions are tables containing rows and columns. The max database size of SQL Database, this managed service, is today 500 gigabytes. That grows regularly. At the moment, that's where it is. The query language is, of course, SQL. Transaction support works across all rows and tables in a database. Now, be clear here. What I'm describing here is the world without the elastic sharding scenario. This is the non-sharded version. If you shard SQL Database, atomic transactions only work across a shard. They don't span shards. Very typical. Are there secondary indexes? Yes. What is that? In relational databases, there's a primary key, a unique identifier for each row. You can also have secondary indexes where you create fast ways to search on other columns. Very useful sometimes. Can you write surplus integers and triggers? Yes, you can. They're in T-SQL, the language we use in SQL Server. And how is it priced? This is interesting. It's priced today in units of throughput. This was not true until recently. Until recently, the challenge of SQL Database, one of the biggest ones, was that the pricing was in terms of the size of your database. And so what you would get is data, but no guarantee of performance. It's a managed service, multi-tenant, shared by many users. Your performance was a function of who else was using the service at the same time you were on your machines. So your perf could vary enormously based on other users' use of the service. Now they've changed that. Now you buy units of throughput from a few to a whole lot based on what you need. And what you get is guaranteed throughput. To me, that's a huge advantage. That's a huge change. It's very important. That makes SQL database much more useful than it might have been in previous years. All right. So we've got SQL database. Why in the world wouldn't we always use it? Why ever use a NoSQL technology on Azure? Well, there are a few reasons why people choose NoSQL. The most common, perhaps, is scalability. You want to scale for lots and lots of users and/or lots and lots of data. So what's good about that? Well, NoSQL gives you more scale, typically, than relational systems. What's bad about that? Well, you lose stuff. You lose things like database-wide transactions. Why? Because NoSQL databases give us scale by sharding. And sharding means that you cannot do, typically, atomic transactions across shards. So you get more scale, but you give up things to get that. Trade-offs, like always. Why else might you use NoSQL on Azure? Well, people use it because they don't want to work with relational databases. They don't want tables. They want, for example, JSON, a JavaScript object notation. What's good about that? Well, it can make your code easier to write. If I can avoid OR mapping, I'm a happy guy, right? If I can take my JavaScript application and just serialize my JavaScript objects as JSON and store those guys in the database to get them back, wow, that's a beautiful thing. Simple, flexible, clean. I love that. People love that. Developers love that. Are there drawbacks? Of course there are drawbacks. There are always trade-offs. For one thing, the BI tools that we might use expect relational data, typically. So you're going to cut out some of the BI stuff you can do. And here's another one. If I do that, if I persist data that reflects my object structures, then I can very easily read that myself. But how do other apps read that data? Their objects are different. Relational databases are normalized, typically, so I can share data more easily. Here, things aren't shared as easily. Now, maybe you'd say, well, sharing a database is wrong anyway. You ought to share data via APIs on the app itself. Okay, valid point. But it's worth thinking about this, that when you persist data that reflects your app's object structure, as you might do here, it can be harder to share. Another big reason why people use NoSQL on Azure is to get away from schema. NoSQL technologies don't have fixed schemas, typically. And so that gives you more flexibility. You need not take databases down and make schema changes. What's bad about that? Well, schema is our friend, right? Schemas help us prevent errors, don't they? So, challenges and benefits. This is the nature of engineering, is it not? That almost everything that brings us benefits has concomitant costs. And this is why, while NoSQL has huge advantages, and there are many cases where it's the right solution, this is why, personally, I don't think we're in the post-SQL era. It's the SQL Plus era. Relational certainly still matters. But if those things are important to you in a given situation, you might want to use NoSQL on Azure. And so, let's discuss the options. DocumentDB, tables, and HBase. I'll start with DocumentDB, which, as we saw earlier, is categorized as a document store, one of the three or four major categories of NoSQL that are commonly talked about. The idea is really simple. In DocumentDB, you don't have tables, you have collections. And a collection contains documents, unsurprisingly. What's a document? Don't think for a minute that a document is like a Word document. No, 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 not what it means. A document means really a collection of JSON. If you've not seen JSON, it looks like that. It's just text. And so there's an example document. Name John, country Canada, age, last use. Do you notice? That's the same set of data in my relational table earlier in SQL database. And so here I'm matching that, written as text, very simple. Well, the great thing about this, one of the great things, is suppose for my second user, I know their name, their country, their age, but not their last use. Well, that's okay. I can just have name, country, age. I can omit last use. That's fine. There's no schema. Or suppose for my third user, I know their name, their age, their country. I don't know their last use, but I know their first use. Well, that's okay too. Now I can have name, country, age, and first use. There's no schema. Or how about this? You know, I'm looking at you guys and I'm thinking, you had lunch recently, didn't you? Right? I can just tell you had lunch recently. There are blood sugar issues with you right now. I say that because you don't look excited, you don't look as excited as you should be about this. This is very cool. Is this not very cool? This is very cool. So, the fourth document here, suppose I want to have a document that just keeps track of the other documents. I can do that too. The doc count, the last update. There is no schema. And so I can put in a collection anything I like in the documents. Nice flexibility. Great. And JSON. Applications can access this and get back the results in, of course, JSON. Beautiful. To work with the data, there are a few choices. There are RESTful access methods for the basic CRUD operations. There's also a query language. Now, think about that, a query language. How should I do a query language on JSON data? Well, JSON is derived from JavaScript, so maybe I want to have a JavaScript-based query language, maybe. But if I do that, then I'm going to force all of you to learn this new query language, right? Well, that's kind of a nuisance. So maybe what I should do is take what you already know and build on that. That's what the creators of this technology did. They chose, rather than building a new language based on JavaScript, for example, they chose to build a language derived from SQL. Their query language is an extended subset of SQL. And so you can query this stuff with queries that look a lot like conventional SQL, in some cases are conventional SQL, like there. That'll return Lou's age from document 3 of the previous slide. Finally, you can also write stored procedures and triggers and UDFs all written in JavaScript. No great surprise here, right, that they're in JavaScript. It's a JSON database. But just to be clear, here's a more complete picture. Collections can contain documents, stored procedures, triggers, UDFs. You access this via this RESTful interface. And if you really enjoy pain and love suffering, you can build those RESTful calls yourself by hand. But to make your life better, they also provide libraries. .NET, JavaScript, Node.js, Python, probably more on the way, I don't know, probably. So just to be clear here, when you write code that runs in the database, it's in JavaScript. When you write code that uses the database, it's in anything you want. And there are libraries for, again, C#, VB, JavaScript, and so on. Do not think that because it's a JSON database and you write the stored procedures, if you choose to, in JavaScript, that you must only write JavaScript apps that use this. Not true. They can be in lots of things, anything you want, really. Okay? So, anybody here ever use Node.js? Any Node fans out there? Yeah. So Node is getting to be a big deal, and Microsoft clearly thinks Node's a big deal. There's pretty good support for Node on Azure. It gets better all the time. Websites, for example, has built-in Node support. So you can do this. Interesting scenario here. You build your clients, the JavaScript client for the browser, something else from native apps for mobile clients. They speak JSON. Your server code's in JavaScript. It can speak JSON to DocumentDB. And your whole world here is JSON and JSON and more JSON, and probably a lot of JavaScript if you choose to go that way. It's interesting. It's plausible that that's going to become the new default for how many of us build very scalable web apps, potentially. Stored procedures are really interesting because you've got these JavaScript JSON documents. You write the sprocs in JavaScript. And the way it works is very straightforward. When you start your stored procedure, your sproc, the JSON document just gets materialized as JavaScript variables. Your JavaScript Sprock then goes ahead and works with those, modifies them, and when you're done, potentially, just writes them back. It's this very natural thing. So it's meant to be a straightforward way to build this kind of logic inside databases. I wrote this short paper on DocumentDB recently. Last weekend, I got an aggrieved email from a guy in Sweden who said, David, in your paper, you actually said that sometimes it is a good thing to write stored procedures. He said, I'm paraphrasing, he said, David, stored procedures are the evil work of the devil. And you know this, right? There's this ongoing decades-long battle between people who write apps, people who write stored procedures. I want to tell you, I take no position in that battle. But what you're seeing here, of course, is DocDB's creators trying to provide the things they think you need, regardless of your position in that particular debate. He was really upset, but I think I calmed him down. So, all right, sharding. Does this guy shard? Sure. It shards by collection. Great. And unsurprisingly then, atomic transactions can only span documents in a collection. As we saw earlier, the boundary of sharding commonly is a transaction boundary, and that's true here as well. Another general topic that you'll see will persist throughout this discussion here is this notion of replication and consistency. Here's the idea. Suppose I have a shard, some chunk of my database on some machine. It is often useful to replicate that shard, have multiple copies. Let's say one's the primary, the read-write copy, others are read-only, secondaries. Not the only way to do it, but it's an example of how you could do it. Replication is useful because it speeds up your application. I can now have reads, potentially, access any replica rather than just one, and it can help availability. Because if a machine fails, data is still available on other machines. This is kind of confusing because that picture looks just like my sharding picture, doesn't it? Machines, multiple data. Don't be confused, please. Replication and sharding are disjoint concepts. Sharding means I divide my database into chunks. Replication means I take each of those chunks and have many copies of them. So my original diagram here actually showed multiple shards, multiple replicas, because that's what it really looks like. You've got shard A, shard B, shard C, and replicas of all those guys. So they're distinct concepts, replication and sharding. Okay? So replication makes good sense. It's a useful thing. But it raises this painful issue. And the painful issue is this. If I do a write, if an app does a write to the primary replica, in my model here, assume the primary is read-write, others are read-only, okay? Then here's what's going to happen. If an application writes to the primary, that write will propagate to the shards, okay? I'm sorry, to the replicas of this shard. How long will that take? Well, the answer is some non-zero period of time. The question is, what does a reader see? What does a reader see? When the read comes in, if the reader accesses the primary, life is good. It'll see the change that was just made. If the read comes in during the propagation time, and it happens to read from a replica that has already gotten the update, life is also good. But what happens if a reader comes in during propagation and it goes to a replica that has not yet been updated? Well, now it's going to see old data, right? You with me here? Is that bad? The answer is maybe. Maybe. There are different ways to deal with this. And let me show you how DocDB deals with them. One approach to this is what's commonly called strong consistency. What you do here, typically, is when a write goes in, the write returns only once it's propagated to a majority of replicas. When you read, your read also reads from not just one, but a majority of the replicas. If you do this, you will always get the correct data, and you will never see out-of-order updates. But you'll be kind of slow. Reads and writes are the slowest if you do this. The other extreme is commonly called eventual consistency. Here, when you do a write, you write to the primary and return. When you do a read, you read from any old replica, any old one at all, regardless whether you've seen the update or not. So what happens here? You might see old data. You might see out-of-order updates. But the speed is the fastest. With eventual consistency, you might get incorrect data, but you'll get it really fast. Right? So is that good? The answer is maybe. There are apps for which that's a better approach than strong. Great. So DocDB supports both. You can control this yourself. But interestingly, there are also points in between those two extremes that DocDB offers you as options. There is bounded staleness, where you might see old data, but only within a time that you define, like 100 milliseconds or something. Here, you won't see things out of order, and you get somewhat faster reads and writes. You can also have what's called session consistency, where you'll always see your own stuff correctly, but you might see old or out of order things written by other users of the database, other clients. There, you get pretty darn fast writes and pretty fast reads. That's the default, interestingly. That's the default in DocDB, because that's the sweet spot for so many apps. Back to my summary table. DocDB is a document store. The abstractions are collections and documents. The max database size is hundreds of terabytes, much bigger than SQL database. The query language, extended subset of SQL, they call it DocumentDB SQL. Okay. Transaction support, all documents in the same collection, right? That's the shard. Secondary indexes, yes, I didn't talk about this, I should have. The truth is that DocDB indexes automatically everything you put in it, everything. All those JSON elements I showed you earlier are indexed automatically, which means you can search quickly on anything in any document. That's interesting. Store partitions and triggers are written in JavaScript. And how is it priced? It is priced like SQL database in that you buy units of throughput. So once again, you can have guaranteed performance. One way you might think about this is that DocumentDB is trying to give you the best of the relational systems with the best of NoSQL. So you have guaranteed performance, you have stored procedures, secondary indexes, but you still get massive size, schema-free operation, and so on. They're trying to hit the best of both worlds here. Next, tables. Another of the big categories in the NoSQL world, key value stores. The idea here is really simple. Now, sadly, my picture's kind of complicated, but trust me, the idea is really simple, okay? So, in the technology called Azure Tables, unsurprisingly, you store data in tables, but they're not relational tables. I kind of wish they weren't called that, actually. Tables are broken into some number of partitions. What's a partition? It's a shard. It's a shard. In each partition is some number of entities. You might call them rows. They're entities. Each entity has some number of properties. Those properties always include a partition key identifying what partition this entity lives in, and what's called a row key, identifying the entity. So here, for example, you can see partition A has two entities, A1 and A2. Partition B has B1 and B2. In each entity, there is then some number of properties. Those properties all have a type and a name. So once again, what you're seeing there is my very same data organization from Mythical Application that's storing data about users. The name the country, the age, the last use, using the data types built into table, string, int, date, and so on. As in DocumentDB, there's no schema. And so my next entity might store just name, country, age. You recall in the document example, I didn't know last use for the second user. I left it out here. For the third user, I have name, country, age, and first use, not last use. I didn't know last use. And recall, the fourth document, my earlier example, was about the count of documents in the last update. I can do that here with count and last. So it's similar. A big difference, however, is the way you access things. I access things by providing a key. In this case, the key is B2. Identify the partition and the row. So I want partition B, entity, or row 2. I get back this stuff. That's why they're called key value stores. You give them a key, you get back a value. Dead simple. Dead simple. Does it shard? Of course it shards. Partitions are shards. And so when you do transactions in this technology, what would you imagine the span of a transaction can be? Gee, a partition maybe? Yeah, right? Very straightforward. It also does replication of the partitions, of the shards, and reads and writes provide strong consistency. They don't do eventual. Back to my table. Tables is a key value store. The core abstractions are tables, partitions, and entities, and arguably properties as well. Max database size, hundreds of terabytes. Once again, big, big databases can be stored here. The query language, it supports, among other things, a subset of OData queries, if you know OData. It supports a subset of some of the things you can do on the OData string. Transaction support, we just talked about this. All entities in the same partition. Secondary indexes, no. It's a key value store. You give it a key, you return the information. You have to know the key. There's no indexing of other entities, other properties in the entity. Triggers and stored procedures, no. Simple key value store. Pricing, this is very interesting. Pricing is gigabytes of storage. Now, to be complete here, you actually pay a little bit for each read and write, a little bit, but it's so low that in most apps it's not really relevant. It can be, but most often it's not. You're paying for gigabytes of storage. So 2 points about that. Number one, in DocDB and SQL Database, you're buying units of throughput, which means you get guaranteed performance. In tables, you are not buying units of throughput. You're buying just gigabytes. And your perf can vary based on other applications using the service. Okay. But the other big point you got to make here is tables is amazingly cheap. It's blob level pricing, pretty much. It's amazingly cheap. Of these options, the cheapest. And so people who have a lot of data to store and want a simple key value store find this the lowest cost option, typically. As always, trade-offs. One more. HD Insight HBase, a column family store. The idea here is really interesting. It's really interesting. I love this topic. This is fun to talk about. HBase actually has tables with columns, and it has rows as well. The columns, though, are interesting. There's a column for row key. Then there are columns, as you can see here, that mimic the columns I showed you earlier. But the columns in HBase are grouped into column families. So the column family user, in this example, contains name, country, age. Usage contains last used and first use. I then can have rows. And the rows contain data. But you got to notice some things here. First of all, notice that some of these columns have multiple versions of the data. HBase lets you have multiple timestamp versions of data, which is interesting. When a client goes to access data, an application, you can specify here the column family usage, The column, last use, right here. The row, two, and the version number. I'm going to return the middle entry in that second to the top green thing in the last use column. That's how you nail these things down. You specify where they are, column family, column, row, and version. It's interesting. Notice also how sparse that table is. Lots of the entries, the fields, don't have values in them. Well, HBase is designed to handle very big and very sparse tables. HBase says, if you want to have a table that has millions of columns and billions of rows, we're good with that. And it does that in part by not storing things as strict tables like this. You know, in a relational database, you got to put null in all those empty spaces. Here, nope, they're just empty. Just empty. Very good for very sparse tables. So suppose I've got a scenario where only one of my rows needs to have a certain kind of value, a certain column type. What do? I just add the column for that single row. I can add columns at runtime. Add a column for the row, put it in there, fine. It works just fine. You could have millions of columns. This is actually implementation of a technology designed by Google called Bigtable. Good name, right? Bigtable. It's designed for really big tables. It's interesting. But notice something else. Thus far, with DocDB, with tables, the shards were visible. Collections, partitions, you saw the shards. See any shards here? You don't. But at the same time, it must shard, right? To store those giant tables, they'll hit in one machine, it's got to shard. So what's going on here? What's going on is really interesting. Before I show you, notice something else. Notice that the row keys are sorted. Sorted. I'm an American, so to me, T's sound like D's. I'm saying sorted. I'm not saying sorted, S-O-R-D-I-D, in the sense of, you know, somehow sleazy. I don't mean they're sleazy. I mean they are sorted. In a relational table, of course, rows have no ordering by definition. Here, you sort the rows by the row key. Why? Well, one of the big reasons is because HBase does sharding in these things it calls regions, but HBase does sharding automatically. HBase internally figures out how to break up the data, spread it across machines, and doesn't expose it to the user. So there's sharding, but you don't see it. Cool. It's cool. It can do that because things are sorted by row key. You can find things where they are. The regions reflect that sort order. But here's the thing. What about transactions? Remember I told you earlier that commonly, transactions are constrained by the shard, as they were in DocDB and in tables. The shard size constrains atomic transactions. Here, how do I do that? The user cannot see the shards. You can't see regions as a user of this. And so, how the heck does the user know where transaction boundaries are? Here's the answer. The answer is that transaction boundaries in HBase are not defined by the region. Rather, in HBase, a transaction can affect only fields in a single row, just one row. Again, trade-offs. Automatic sharding, beautiful. But the constraint then is doing transactions across the shard is impossible. The user can't see where the shard is, what the shard is, what the boundaries are. And HBase can change those things over time under the covers. And of course, regions are replicated, and reads and writes provide strong consistency. Great. So once again, here's our table. HC Insight, HBase, is a column family store. It turns out that people use different names for this category. Some folks will say wide column store. The most common one I see is column family. but they mean the same thing in this context. The abstractions, tables, rows, columns, cells, column families. The max size, again, hundreds of terabytes. There is no query language. What I showed you is what you do, very simple thing. You can do table scans. There are also no data types. In HBase, each element is a byte string. There are no data types. Straightforward. The transactions are quite limited. All cells in a single row can be a transaction. There's no secondary index support, but there is support for stored procedures, something called coprocessors written in Java. And the pricing here on Azure, the pricing on Azure is you pay for storage and you also pay for VMs per hour. Because the way this works is you actually create an HBase cluster running as VMs on Azure and you store data in blobs. So you pay for blob storage and you pay for your cluster while it's running. So there's a summary of operational data options here. The upper left-hand corner of my four-quadrant picture I showed you earlier. The bottom three rows are the NoSQL technologies. The top row is the SQL Managed Service SQL database. I want to talk next about the upper right-hand corner of that box. That box, remember, was occupied by only a single technology, Hadoop. And what's driving this, of course, is the massive increase in data that we see, driven in no small part by the drop in price. People have done estimates here of relative pricing, and it's absolutely amazing. In the last 30 years, from almost $200,000 per gigabyte to store things, down to what, 7 cents a gigabyte? It's astonishing. And so when things get much cheaper, you get more of something, more relational data, of course. Please notice, my line is linear, but my scale is exponential. So in fact, the growth was not linear. But you get way more non-relational stuff, videos, JPEGs, log data, Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff. It is that part of this diagram that is largely the driver for big data analytics. And so, as I've said about 10 times, I think, so far, in that space, Hadoop has pretty much won. So what is Hadoop? Quick survey here. Hadoop is a family of technologies that runs on a cluster of physical or virtual machines. At the bottom of the family is HDFS, the Hadoop Distributed File System. HDFS lets you build big binary files that span machines. You can have files that are way too big for one machine, and an app can still view them as a single file. On top of HDFS run a variety of things, such as HBase. HBase is part of this family, and it runs in HDFS. On top of this also, today in the modern world, is this thing called YARN, Yet Another Resource Negotiator, which is a way to have a variety of things using HDFS. HBase is not commonly yet built using this. It probably will be going forward. It's not commonly done this way today. On top of YARN, the most well-known technology is the MapReduce stuff. When people say Hadoop, they often mean MapReduce, but they shouldn't. Because increasingly, there's more and more stuff running here. There is, for example, this thing called Storm, which does event processing, real-time event processing. So with the addition of YARN, more and more things can run on top of HDFS. All of these are provided on Azure as managed services by this thing called HD Insight. How it's implemented is really interesting. So look at this. HD Insight MapReduce is a way to run applications in parallel. You break the app into lots of pieces, and you run them with this approach called MapReduce. I'm not going to describe that. You break your MapReduce job, your application, into discrete pieces and run different chunks in different VMs. They then access data stored in Azure blobs. But I told you earlier that Hadoop runs over HDFS, right? Well, what they do here is implement the HDFS API. So vanilla Hadoop jobs can run here just fine because they think they're running over HDFS. But in fact, data is stored in blobs. There are other ways to generate MapReduce jobs, you're running them yourself. Technologies called Hive and Pig and some others. You know, I love this. I didn't mention this. These are all open source things. You can tell they're open source by the names. No marketing guy would ever let his technology be called Pig, right? Never gonna happen. So the open source guys don't care very much. Microsoft's added Excel here as well. You could actually submit MapReduce jobs from Excel and get the results back. It's interesting. And HBase is also built on this same foundation. So when I told you HBase pricing is a function of VMs and gigabytes of storage, it's blob storage down here, and it's VMs in a cluster up there running HBase. That's how they price it. So HD Insight is this family of things. They've also just put into preview Storm, which is this event processing technology that runs up there as well. So there you have it. A quick tour through NoSQL technologies on Azure. I want to end by discussing something you probably didn't expect. I keep saying that it's the SQL plus world. I'm uncomfortable calling it the NoSQL world, clearly. It's SQL, it's NoSQL, and it's more than that as well. I want to end by talking about the more, because the more is something you might not have heard of yet, in at least in much detail. It's search. Here's the thing. Much of my talk so far has been about operational data, an application that uses a relational or a NoSQL store to do reads and writes, the thing that we all do, right? It's your database for your transactions, your customers, your employees, whatever you're doing. It's operational data. Great. Suppose that you also want to make it possible for the user to access that data via search, like a search box. Suppose you want to do that. How would you implement that? Well, it's kind of hard to do by yourself. It's kind of hard. There is value in having a search service, a separate search service that maintains indexes that you can use to actually send search requests and get search results back. Azure Search provides that. Azure Search is a managed service running on Azure, designed to help people like you build applications that provide search to their users. Do not be confused. This is not a service you can use directly. There's no UI. It's accessed via RESTful interface. It's designed for app developers to be able to add search to their own UI. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, here are some examples. If you are building an online retailer site, like an online shoe store, you could do this. Your UI could be built as a bunch of clicks. You could have opening choices, shoes, men's, women's, children. I click on women's. You could then bring up high heels, sneakers, flats. I click on high heels. You could then bring up options for stilettos, pumps. I click on stilettos. I could do that in my UI. My business would fail within about a week, a day. People hate that. People expect a search interface, not this click, 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 click. They expect type in high heels, get back high heels. So it makes perfect sense. We all expect search for online retail, right? How do those guys build that? How would you build that? Well, Azure Search is designed to address scenarios like that. Or how about this? Suppose you're building some kind of site that supports user-generated content, like a discussion site for movies or something in your own company. Once again, you could ask users to access data they want via menu options. Click here, click here, click there, dig into this thing. People would hate that. They want to search for, I don't know, Spider-Man, Guardians of the Galaxy, some cool movie, and find data about that. People expect search in those scenarios. But how about this? How about the next app you build that's for your own employees, like a benefits application? In that world, people are kind of accustomed to just doing click, 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 click down to some kind of hierarchy. But if you gave them a search box, would they not be happier? Don't all of us prefer search? Man, I sure do. You give me a search, I'm going to use it right away. Won't you? People love search. Requires no training, dead easy to use, And the web conditions us all to want to use search. Why doesn't every application have a search box in its interface? People would like it. Well, the reason has been, arguably, that it's hard. You're not going to build your own search engine. And even to deploy a commercial one requires that you stand up the server and manage it and so on. Azure Search is meant to be a service that runs on Azure, sits there, you can just use it to build apps that do search. The apps can run on-premises or in the cloud. Either one. That's the point. So, let's think about this. Suppose you're the online shoe retailer and you want to have search added to your application. You've got a search box. Now, let's be really clear here. As I said before, Azure Search says nothing at all about your UI. Nothing. There's no UI components. I made this up. But this is the canonical view of a search box with the magnifying icon and so on. You need not do this. In fact, Azure Search supports, you could build a map style interface where you have a bounding box and say search in this range if you want to. You don't have to do this. But the most common way to do a search interface today is a search box like this. So let's think about what Azure Search would have to provide to make it tractable, doable for you to build applications that expose this kind of search UI. All right, I type hi. What do you expect? You expect suggestions, right? So Azure Search actually supports this. Your app can make calls to Azure Search as the user types to return suggestions that you have supplied as potential options. Cool. Now, the user picks something, high heels, clicks return. They get back results. In the simplest case, those results might just be text. What do users expect? They expect that their search terms are highlighted in the results. Azure Search supports this by wrapping the search terms in an emphasis tag, the EM tag for HTML, to make this easy to show for your app. Critically, people also expect control over the order of search results. Some of you are thinking this, I'm sure you're thinking, well, wait a minute, why would I build my own search engine or build my own search function based on an Azure Search engine? I can just use Google or Bing and scope them to my site. You can do that. That is true. However, if I do that, I can't control the results. The order of the results. Why do I want to do that? Well, there are really good reasons. If you're an online shoe store and you've got this enormous stock of a certain model you want to unload, put those first, thank you. If you're an online shoe store and you've got this deal with one of the manufacturers where they're going to pay you extra money to promote their shoes, put them first too. And you're thinking, well, that's kind of sleazy. No, no, that's called business. Right? That's called business. So you want to control the order of search results. That's really important. It's a big part of why you're doing this. Now, an online shoe store with a UI like this would crash and burn. People expect something more like that, right? They want a pretty kind of thing. This requires more information. And so your search service must return more than just what I showed you before. It must return things like pictures and more data than I showed you before. And look over there on the left. You've seen those all the time, haven't you, in search interfaces? You've got categories like that, help with your next search. Your search service must support doing that as well. Azure Search does all these things. Let me show you how. So, to use this technology, you must first create an index, When you define the index, you define its schema. This is not NoSQL. There are schemas here. Here's a simple example from my shoe store. There's a category element, like high heels, sneakers. Sorry, I'm an American. Sneakers. You'd say trainers, probably, right? Trainers is a much nicer thing. I like the idea of training more than sneaking. It's a string, and look at this. There are attributes. Let me just quickly walk through these. Searchable means that a user can search for this. Suggestions means you can have suggestions. There's support for that in the UI, in, for example, the search box. Sortable means you can return results sorted by this. Retrieval means you can retrieve this information. And filterable means that the user can filter based on this. The default is you get back everything. Queries can filter as well to return the results in certain ways. So for my shoe store, my schema has category. It has the brand, who makes this shoe. It has the style. If it's high heels, maybe it's pumps and stilettos and whatever. Okay. It has the color. Notice this. Color is a collection of strings, because the same shoe might come in red and black and green and purple and so on. Notice that color is not sortable. How do you sort on a collection of strings? But color is facetable. What the heck does that mean? Well, I'll tell you in a minute, because look at the next one. It's price. Price is searchable, it's sortable, but there are no suggestions. You can't make suggestions on price, can't you? Typing a price, you're gonna suggest numbers for me? That's crazy. No suggestions for price. But notice that both color and price are facetable. If you recall the UI I showed you before, on the far left, there were those columns of color and price with numbers. Facetable means you can actually query the search engine and get back those numbers, those counts. So those two guys let you do that. The goal there is to help the search engine, the search service, I'm sorry, return the information you need to have the UI you want, users expect. Facetable is what determines that. Picture. Well, picture's a string. Why? Because it holds a URL. You can put stuff in here. More likely, you'd have a URL to a blob. And the picture of the shoe is a JPEG sitting on Azure Blobs that you point to via URL here. And notice that's just retrievable. You can't search on it. You can't sort on it. Nothing else. And finally, there's two more things. There's the number of shoe, this shoe in stock, an int. And there's promotion, a Boolean. That determines whether you're running a promotion on this shoe or not. Is there a special promotion? But notice those two elements. They have no attributes at all. They're not searchable. They're not retrievable. Why have data in your index you can't retrieve? Well, the answer is you can use those to order your search results. How and why? I'll tell you in a minute. Once you've got your index, you can then populate it with data. That data is probably drawn from your operational database. Not necessarily, but probably. So here, for example, my online shoe retailer might look like this. The category is sneakers. The brand is Contoso. This is the first row. High tops, the color, the price, the picture. There's a promotion here. The next two are both high heels from Contoso. Notice that the first one, the pumps, has a huge number in stock, 285. Second is only 23. That's interesting. Notice also that there's a promotion running for Contoso, all the Contoso brands, but not for the Fabricam brands. Well, that's interesting. Remember, those right two columns I cannot retrieve, but they help me determine search result ordering. With me so far here? So, the search happens. The user types high heel to the search box with the suggestions, perhaps. That's sent off to Azure Search via a RESTful call. The search is done for the index. The results are sent back and displayed as the app sees fit. My simple example there displays as I showed you before. And so what you get back on a search for high heels is this, the stuff in red. That is what can be used by the app to build the UI it wants to create for the user. Notice that. Over there on the right, Contoso is above Fabricam because there's a promotion running for Contoso. Promotion was true for Contoso. And pumps appear before stilettos because there are so many pumps in stock. Those numbers were used, those values were used to define the order of the results here. Really important. Not sleazy. Business. And over here on the left, facets, as I said, make possible displays like that. You can request the number of red shoes, the range, number of shoes in the price range between 100 and 250, because those were facetable. So, Azure Search is designed to provide the things that you need to build the search UI that you want. I got to tell you, people, I love search. You love search. Your users love search. With the availability of an engine, a service that makes search easier to do, I would expect to see more and more and more and more apps have a search box in their UI. Because why the heck not? People like it, it's doable. The one last piece of the puzzle, your index must be updated. On the web, Google, Bing, and so on, they run crawlers all the time, doing updates all the time. There are currently no crawlers with Azure Search. Could that change? Sure. But there are currently no crawlers. You do this yourself instead. So you could do this. You could ask your operational store for changes and update the search yourself, or you could even, every time you make a change operational, update the index as well. Keep them in sync if you chose to. But right now, it's up to you to do this. All right. Let's wrap this up. Traditionally, the world looked like this. You had applications that used relational stores, relational databases, for their operational data. Those, through the common ETL process, fed a relational database, fed analytical data, and you built BI applications that used that, commonly used by internal users. That's the model of data that I suspect most of you have in your organizations today. You do something like this. Going forward, that's expanding to look like this. Operational data includes relational and NoSQL databases. In part because of that, analytical data is also expanding to have relational data warehouses and unstructured data lakes. You've not seen that term. Data lake is the vogue term for unstructured data warehouse at this point. I try to be cool, but it's hard. You build BI apps over all that stuff, and then I would suggest to you that you could and probably should think of search data as its own separate category that your applications use. I'm telling you, why doesn't every app have search? Why isn't search as ubiquitous as the other options here? This session has focused on Azure solutions for all of those categories, and so here they are. For relational data warehouses on Azure, you run things in a VM like SQL Server. For unstructured analytical data, HD Insight Hadoop. For operational data, SQL Server in a VM or SQL Database. For NoSQL stores, DocDB, Tables, HBase, three big choices there. And for search data, Azure Search. When should you use each of those? It's fairly obvious, isn't it? In the SQL Plus world, you want to use SQL Database when you want relational data and you want your app up as fast as possible. You can always run your own DBMS in an IaaS VM. You must install it, manage it, and so on. It's not quite true. It might be installed for you, but never mind. You got to manage it still. Here, SQL Database is a service. Your app is up as fast as possible. Your management is as minimal as possible. You want to choose a NoSQL option, DocDB, Tables, HD Insight, HBase, when you want NoSQL for scalability, for different data model, for no schema. You want to choose Hadoop for analyzing big data, non-relational analytical data. You want to choose Azure Search when you want to do search, when you want to have a search interface for your application. And there you have it. To end where I began, NoSQL technologies are a fundamental part of Azure today. I could also just as well say that SQL Plus technologies are a fundamental part of Azure today. I've talked about several categories, operational data, analytical data, search data. And my last point here, my last thought is this. Welcome to the SQL Plus era. You're going to like it. Thank you very much.